Blog Talk Radio.
University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, saying America is a melting pot is considered racist and sexist. Or asking a Asian or Latino or Native American as a professor, if you ask an individual who has the ethnic affiliation with one of those groups, why are you so quiet? That is a microaggression. It's tantamount, according to UCLA, to giving the order, assimilate. If you say there's only one race, the human race, you are a racist. It's offensive because it's denying the significance of a person of color's racial or ethnic experience and history. Or, God forbid, you should say, America is the land of opportunity. According to UCLA, this implies that people of color are lazy or incompetent, and they need to work harder because this implies that they haven't taken advantage of those opportunities. Now, this is not some marginal, freaky, a few nutty professors. This whole demand that professors abide by new standards that minimize what are called microaggressions, I'll get to what a microaggression is in a minute, comes down from UC President Janet Napolitano. UC faculty have been across the entire University of California, have been asked to attend seminars so that they can foster an informed conversation about the best way to build and nurture a productive academic climate. How can you be against building and nurturing a productive academic climate? But that's really, as this in the Daily Beast informs us, this really is just bureaucratic speak for learn to keep your mouth shut. Don't offend. Don't challenge. Don't upset. Don't emotionally upset anybody. So now you might say, well, this is California. It's just nuts. But this is a phenomenon all across the United States. Every university and every college out there today has rules and restrictions around what they're called microaggressions and trigger warnings. So what's a microaggression? A microaggression, this is from an article. By the way, an excellent article that I would recommend everybody read. It's well written. It's I don't agree with everything in the article, and we'll talk a little bit about that stuff. But there's a lot of good material about this issue, and very critical of our universities and our educational system in an appropriate way. And this is an article published in the Atlantic, and indeed, I think I don't have the actual paper copy of the Atlantic magazine, but the Atlantic magazine is kind of a left of center magazine, but quite an intellectual magazine, and not, the nutty, nihilistic, crazy progressives of the left. This is a much more reasonable left, if you will. And this is a fabulous article called The Coddling of the American Mind. And just the title is great because The Coddling of the American Mind is exactly what this whole phenomenon is about. It's about not challenging students. It's about not letting students think. It's about rejecting thinking. It's about elevating emotion to primacy, and we'll talk about that. And indeed, the subtitle of the article is In the Name of Emotional Well-Being, College Students Are Increasingly Demanding Protection from words and ideas they don't like. So, you know, this is a real phenomenon going on all across the country. Again, I highly recommend the article. It's written by Greg Lukianoff, who is the CEO of FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, and does excellent work. As an often I've worked with them. I think I've been on some panels with Greg Lukianoff. Good guy. They do excellent work in defending free speech on campuses. He also, the co-author of this is also Jonathan Haidt, who is a very interesting psychologist and writer and thinker, who's one of his books I've got on my Kindle. It's up next for reading. Anyway, microaggression, according to this article, are small actions or word choices that seem on their face to have no malicious intent, but that are thought of as a kind of violence anyway. These are small actions or word choices that seem on their face to have no malicious intent. And indeed might not have any malicious intent by the speaker or by the... But that are thought of by somebody to be a form of violence. Now that in and of itself is bizarre. Words, unless they are directly inciting violence, are not violence. Words are not actions. Speech cannot be violence, again, unless it's inciting. So microaggressions, things like I described earlier, things like saying there's only one race, the human race. That's a microaggression against people who identify themselves. That's violence. Violence, according to these people, against people who have identified themselves with a particular race or ethnicity. And these days, by the way, to identify yourself with a particular race or ethnicity, you don't actually have to be of that race or ethnicity. You can identify yourself as being of a race or ethnicity that you actually weren't born into. I mean, we'll get to subjectivism in a minute, but you know, it's that level of subjectivity. It's whatever you feel like you belong to. That is a race. That, anyway, that's an example of a microaggression. Let's see. I had another one here. This professor, and this is actually Haidt, was teaching a class, classic discussion on wisdom, you know, and he assigned a magazine article that described the dilemma of a physician faced with one of his patients dying of cancer. Now, that's just, you know, a description of somebody dying of cancer. And a student complained because he felt that that could create negative feelings and upset somebody, i.e. a microaggression, of somebody who might have lost a relative recently to cancer. And that the professor should have, before having the students read this article, provided what's called a trigger warning, so that those students who might have been upset, not even offended in this case, right? This is just a factual story of somebody dying from cancer, and you had a relative die of cancer, so you might be upset. But you want to protect people from being upset, so you need to provide a trigger warning to let the student know so that they could maybe not read the article, or maybe they could just prepare themselves emotionally for the trauma of being reminded of the relative dying from cancer. And trigger warnings, according to the article, define those, are alerts, the little statements, that professors are expected to issue if something in the course, anything in the course, any reading, any discussion, any statement they might make in the course might cause a strong emotional response. Now, of course, you have to be able to predict what will cause somebody else a strong emotional response. And in this case, if you're teaching a class, let's say of 30 or 40 students, you have to predict what potentially might cause a strong emotional response in 30 or 40 different students. And therefore, you have to provide a trigger warning. For example, If you're teaching Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby, it is expected today on many American campuses, not just in California. Don't you guys get all huffy about crazy Californians all over the country. If you're teaching The Great Gatsby, you have to provide a trigger warning because The Great Gatsby portrays physical abuse. And there might be a student in your class who has previously been victimized by racism or domestic violence. And then they can choose not to read this book. They get to choose what they read and what not to read. And the only basis for the choice, the only basis for the choice is what might upset them. Haight also tells the story of teaching Ulysses to, you know, the story of Ulysses, and that, you know, he's teaching the section where Ulysses ties himself to the pole in order to avoid the lure of the sirens. I don't know how many of you have read, you know, the story, right, Ulysses? And, you know, he the sirens lure you to your death, so he had his men tie him up you know, usually people covered their ears not to hear the sirens, but the siren song was beautiful. So Ulysses says, I want to hear the beauty of the siren songs, but I don't want to be lured by them, so tie me up and don't release me no matter what. But when he showed this, he showed a famous painting of Ulysses being tied up. Right? Ulysses, I'm mispronouncing it, so I apologize. Ulysses being tied up. And the mermaids are in the background, and the mermaids are topless, as they often are in paintings. Well, students complained there should have been a trigger warning over the nudity because portraying women topless is degrading to women. And it was incredibly insensitive to show this. And some people who might view this as insensitive should be allowed, you know, to warn so they could close their eyes or, I don't know, not attend that particular class because they might be offended. Now, this is going on all over the country. Indeed, there's an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times by, let's see, who are these guys? These are two presidents. So one of them is a president of a university. Let me see. President and professor of sociology at Lucid Clark College. That's a humanities college. And the other person is a president of Northwestern University, major, major university in Chicago, not California. You see, this is all over the country. And they wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times August 30th, just a week ago, defending these practices and saying, look, you baby boom generation, you got to understand there's enormous injustice out there. There's a lot of racism out there. And we've got to protect our kids. These kids are sensitive. They're emotionally sensitive. And we got to protect them. And, you know, it might be subtle little comments, but we need to stop this. We need to stop the things that might offend people because we strive towards a utopia in which nobody is offended. And of course, as many of you know, the only time you're not offended is when you're dead or when there's no speech allowed, when free speech is crushed. It struck me that one of their examples was just... I mean, it's so childish. It's so frigging childish. It's so emotions first and pretending, you know, the people get this immense trauma. So these two guys who wrote this op-ed are both Jewish, and they say, you know, so this is a quote from the op-ed, and they say, both of us, when we were younger, were told that we didn't look Jewish. Oh, my God. I mean... maybe the person who said that was a racist and anti-Semit, and that's horrible. But here's what they say. In such remarks, if such remarks don't wound us to the core, wound, violence, physical. They go on, why is it that we remember them for a lifetime? Oh, my God, these guys. I mean, can you imagine two university professors being so sensitive that they think that somebody telling them they look Jewish has wounded them to the core? Imagine these guys would have completely collapsed and committed suicide if they'd lived in 1930s Germany. Talk about wounding to the core, wearing a yellow star, being hooded into ghettos. That's wounding to the core. That is a real offense. That's violence against you. Somebody says you look Jewish and might be a little anti-Semitic, walk away from them. I remember being asked, and I guess because I remember this, it must have wounded me to the core. Because, you know, I'm a sensitive soul. I remember being asked, in America in 1979, somewhere in the South, whether Jews had horns. I'm serious. I'm not kidding here. Whether Jews had horns. Now, that is stupid. The person who said it is clearly anti-Semitic. But a healthy approach to that would be saying, what an idiot. What an anti-Semitic idiot. What a racist idiot. But how does that wound me to the core? How does somebody else's bigotry, how does somebody else's racism, how does somebody else's irrationality and stupidity wound me to the core unless they use physical violence against me? Yeah, I mean, it really is unbelievable to me that these two presidents of university, I'm not talking about little dinky universities and, you know, irrelevant universities. We're talking about Lewis and Clark College, a major college, and Northwestern University, one of the premier universities. The presidents of these universities are telling us that making a statement that somebody looks Jewish is wounding to the core. No, it might be stupid. I don't even know if one would say that something like that indeed is racist, but I can just imagine somebody saying that's anti-Semitic. But why would that wound you again? Why would somebody else's words wound you? A stranger's word wound you? I mean, generally in life, when somebody says something to you, there are only two options. Let's say they criticize you. They say something unnice to you. They say something bigoted to you. They could be right or they could be wrong. If they're wrong, why do you care? Just walk away. If they're right, say thank you. You've learned something new. But where does this wounding to the core have anything to do with anything? All right. Well, this is where we are today, guys. This is where we are. You know, people, according to these professors, massive numbers of our students are suffering from psychological harm, from repeated affronts. It used to be in this country that we had racism. Real racism, real discrimination, real violence against people because of the color of their skin or because of their religion or because of their ethnicity. And luckily, that has been reduced significantly. It hasn't gone away. And we should fight racism ideologically. And when it manifests in violence, we should fight it using the police, the courts. This level of sensitivity, which treats not everybody equal, but those who come from minorities, those who come from groups who might have been discriminated against in the past, that treats them with this ridiculous level of sensitivity, that treats them as these precious souls that can never hear anything negative. We can't even ask them to speak up in class, because you might offend them because, I don't know, Asians are supposed to be quiet. Is that what the issue is? And by asking them to speak up, you're trying to make them white? I don't even know. Elevating them above everybody else. That is not even bringing about equality, treating everybody the same. It's treating some people, some points of view. And ultimately, and we'll go to break on this point. Ultimately, what this is all about is elevating emotions. Elevating the emotions of those most likely to be offended. Elevating the emotions of those most sensitive emotionally to the top of the values hierarchy. We'll talk more about that, how we got to this position, what the causes of the state of the world is when we come back after this break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's AYNRAND.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Well, this movement around microaggression and trigger warnings and you can't offend anybody, there's certain things you cannot say on campus, this now goes well beyond the political correctness of the 80s and 90s and 2000s. This is not just about the certain ideas that are offensive, the certain whole systems of thought that cannot be addressed. This goes far beyond that into innocent-sounding statements that now students, more so than faculty, find offense. So this is really, I'd say, something that's come about in the last few years, and it's really a movement that's come from, largely, not exclusively, from students. Now they're motivated by particular writings and particular authors, but this is something that is spreading throughout the country, not so much from leftist intellectuals, but from the students themselves. What's interesting is that many on the left are finding this horrific. There have been a series of articles written by professors on the left that have denounced this phenomena, that have described the phenomena, that described how fearful, how afraid they are to teach a class. Because the other thing that is happening that gives students this incredible power is that if in the past the student who was offended, you know, maybe went to the professor and told him, or maybe even went to the administration and told the administration and some process was begun. Today, what these kids are doing is they're going directly onto social media. They're going directly onto social media and condemning these professors. And then it starts expanding and all these other students get in on it, and these so-called social justice warriors get involved. And then suddenly the administration is faced not just by one student complaining, but by what seems like a whole movement of students complaining. And then the response is far, far harsher than it used to be. Far, far harsher than it used to be. Indeed, there was an article, and I'll see if I can find the name of it in a minute, but an article in Vox by a liberal professor, a leftist professor, saying how afraid he was, and I think it was anonymous, so I'm not even sure if it's a he or she. Oh, you're not allowed to say, it's another thing. I need to find that article. It's another thing. You're not allowed to say he or she anymore. Do you know this? Now, this is from the University of Tennessee. Let me see if I can find this. I know I had this here, but you know, according to the University of Tennessee, yeah, there it is. They backtrack on this, but the initial guidelines for professors were, you're not allowed in class to say he or she. You're supposed to say Z. And that's so you don't offend people who haven't decided what gender they are. They might not be a he, or they might not be a she, or they might be a she who thinks it's a he, or a he who thinks they're a she, or they might be a he or she who hasn't decided whether they're he or a she, or a he or a she who wants to be both a he and a she. So what you're supposed to say, there's a whole list of words that you're supposed to use for this. You're supposed to say Z or Xi. There's actually a whole list of these bizarre, they're not even words, right? Because they're just combinations of letters. What does Z-E mean? There's no word in English, Z-E. But they're inventing one. What you need is gender neutral, but not just gender neutral in the sense that a lot of us complained, I don't know, 20 years ago about having every sentence to say he/she, because in the old days, he was considered gender neutral. You used he as a general statement for both men and female, male and female. Whenever you wanted to make a generalization, you used the male. Well, but that's racist. That's sexist. So you had to now do he/she. Well, but that assumes that there are only two options, a he or she. But what about the situation where it's a he or she or he, she, or whatever? Well, since you don't know anybody's, and you can't look and see, you can't use perception to identify gender anymore. So we've got a new word in the English language called Z or Xi. They can't even decide which word it is. But the University of Tennessee had like five different options that you could use of gender-neutral pronouns. Gender-neutral pronouns. These are new words that are neutral. And there were so many complaints, this is in Tennessee, from the Republican legislature that threatened to withhold funds from the university that the university had to withdraw this. I'm sure they got alumni protests and the Board of Trustees withdrew it. This is after the Chancellor of the University and the President of the University all defended this for a week. They were defending this argument, this position about the he, she, whatever. This is how bad it's become. Right? This is where we are today. So that liberal professors are afraid of going into class. Liberal professors now have trigger warnings on everything. I'm not even talking about conservatives or libertarians, because they don't, or objectivists, because they don't really count, because there's such a small minority of them on university campuses. I'm talking about mainstream leftists who are afraid to talk about this. You can't have anything discussing race without warning in advance. You can't have anything discussing sex or rape. This is an interesting one, right? In law schools, there's such a topic called rape law. That is the law, the criminal law, as it relates to rape cases. And I'm sure there are rules of evidence, and there's a bunch of things that relate to that, in terms of criminal law. And it's an important part of the law, because it's important that we have an understanding of what constitutes rape and how to prosecute rapists and how to present a defense when somebody is accused of rape, because not every accusation is right, is true. So you have to study rape law, just like you have to study the law that relates to murder, or the law that relates to drunk driving, or the law that relates to a lot of different things. Anyway, in a number of law schools, students have asked that rape law not be taught because it is offensive, because it would trigger people who might have been raped or might have been sexually abused, or might trigger the fear of some students of being raped. So don't teach rape law, because it might be offensive. I mean, is that nuts or what? Is that irrational? Who does that help? Who does that protect? If you're interested in talking about this, 347-324-3075. And when you call, indicate, there should be a menu option to indicate that you're calling to ask a question. If you're on the chat and you want to ask a question, put it in bold or something, but related to this topic. If you want to tell us a story about this happening in your campus, this happening to you, or if you're a professor, if you're a student, feel free to do so. Call us, 347-324-3075. Where do you think this comes from? Where do you think this comes from? How did we get to the place that law schools cannot teach rape law out of fear of offending one of the students, again, who might have been raped, or who might have been sexually abused, or who might just fear the rape? All right, we're going to take our first call right here. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, Yaron. This is Dave from Portland, Oregon, back again.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
Oh, great.
Good.
Hey, what's jumping out for me is this equating of physical aggression with microaggression, the coddling of the mind, is that possibly an effect of the second-handedness with the indoctrination of collectivism and altruism? And kind of where I'm going with that is, if reality is second-hand, through others, by others, for others, then to control one's survival, they would have to control other people, hence by speech, et cetera, versus learning in a first-handed way to control their own mind, productivity, physical resources.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's definitely a collectivistic, this is filled with collectivism all over the place, right? It's filled with racial and ethnic identity, and the fact that we get our identity from our race and our ethnicity, but nobody is allowed to point that out, because if they point it out, they might be racist. But, we get our emotional strength and stability from the group that surrounds us. To be an individual means to think for oneself. I mean, even to talk to people about being individualism and individuality is a microaggression. because they don't feel that way, because they feel like they're part of a group. So there's no question this is part of the collectivization that has been instituted in our schools. There is no knowledge. It's the group that has knowledge, and therefore we have to feel protected by the group. The group is everything. Other people are everything. I mean, the whole idea of being so offended by somebody else saying something is in a sense, you know, a form of this collectivism, right? Truth comes from others. Reality, not just truth. Reality comes from others. And therefore, our emotional well-being comes from others. We cannot be emotionally healthy if other people are saying unnice things about us, or at least we're interpreting what they're saying is unnice. So yeah, I definitely think there's a strong sense of this collectivism. And the collectivism comes from somewhere deeper, which I'll get to in a minute, which is subjectivism. If we're subjectivist, if there is no truth, if our emotions are guide for truth, then how do we know anything? We know stuff from other people, from the group, because we can't trust our own minds. We can't trust our own evaluation. We can't trust our own values. All we can trust is our emotions. All we can trust is what the group tells us is good and right. So, yes, there's this incredible sense of, collectivism is both the cause and, more importantly, the consequences of this attitude.
Yes, yeah, that was really jumping out at me, and great topic. I appreciate.
And here's a powerful quote, and this is an important essay, which I encourage everybody to read. You can actually listen to it online at the Ayn Rand bookstore. But this is Leonard Peikoff's, the philosopher Leonard Peikoff, from the American School, Why Johnny Can't Think. It's a talk he gave at Ford Hall Forum in 1984. And it was published in the Objectivist Forum, which I encourage everybody to buy because it's got some fantastic essays in this. But one of them is basically an essay based on that speech that Dr. Peikoff gave in 1984. And he says, this is a quote, remember, this is 1984. He says, despite their talk about self-expression, today's educators have to inculcate collectivism. So this is your point, David. Man's organ of individuality. This is the key sentence. This explains really everything here. Man's organ of individuality is his mind. Deprived of that, he is nothing and can do nothing but huddle in a group as his only means of survival. So by attacking the mind in American universities in a systematic, consistent level for the last 50 years, in Western culture, in Western philosophy for the last 200 and some years since Immanuel Kant, by attacking the mind, we attack the individual. And therefore, we inculcate collectivism. By attacking the mind, we attack the mind. We attack reason. We attack thought. And what do we leave people with? What is left when they can't count on their thinking? When they can't count on their reason? When they can't count on rationality? What is left? What is left?
The group.
Well, the group, but in your own, inside yourself, what is left?
Nothing. Your toast.
Your emotions.
Your emotion,
what is left is emotion. And that's what guides everything you do. And therefore, if somebody says something that you find emotionally upsetting for whatever reason, because you can't use reason to evaluate your emotion, so it's for whatever reason, then you being offended is as legitimate as Newton's laws of physics, because we've raised emotions to be primaries. We've raised emotions to be our guides of knowledge, our guides of facts, our guides of what's offensive, our guides of what is an aggression. It's all about emotion. And on that, thank you. Thanks, Dave, for calling, as usual. Hope you're having a good day in Portland. And We're going to take another quick break, and we'll be right back to talk more about emotions. And
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org to today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today at Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at AynRand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's AynRand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
All right, we're back, and we're talking about the emotionalism of today's students and where it comes from. And, I, you know, Leonard Peikoff wrote this essay or delivered this talk in 1984. And again, I highly, highly recommend reading this. Of course, reading everything Dr. Peikoff has written is highly recommended. You can find a recording of his talk on the e-store on the Ayn Rand Institute. And I recommend that. But let me just read you again, 1984, what Dr. Peikoff did is he went and actually did some research. He went and sat in on some classes that being taught in primary and high schools all across the country. And he titled the essay, Why Johnny Can't Think. And he had just some observations, and I'm not going to quote a lot, but just some observations. This essay is brilliant, and it's so, just like Ayn Rand, it so explains everything going on today. The power of philosophy, the power of ideas, it just stuns me. I'm not a philosopher, but when I read Leonard or when I read Ayn Rand, and they write stuff that's 20 or 30 or 40 years old, and explains everything going on right now, in front of us, that just is stunning to me, and again, a massive illustration of the power of ideas. So this is what Leonard writes. In the classroom discussion I saw, the students were regularly asked by the teacher to state their own opinion. They were asked it in regard to issues about which they clearly had no idea how to have an opinion, since they had no knowledge of the relevant facts or principles, and no idea of the methods of logical argument. What Dr. Peikoff is documenting in this essay is the fact that kids in the 1980s were not being taught facts, they were not being taught principles, and they were not being taught to think. They were not being taught to think. I go on as a quote from Dr. Peikoff. The anti-conceptual epistemology, and according to Peikoff, the causes of all these problems, certainly this ridiculous microaggression trigger warning issues epistemology. The anti-conceptual epistemology that grips them comes from John Dewey, comes from philosophy, and from all his fellow irrationalists and fellow skeptics who dominate 20th century American culture. And he goes on to say, epistemology is the basic cause. They're not being taught to think. Why are they not being taught to think? Because Dewey and the rest of the neo-Kantians, in a sense, don't believe in thinking. They don't believe there are facts. They don't believe in logic. They certainly don't believe in principles. So what is there to teach? What is there to teach if you don't believe those things? Well, what you teach is random concretes. Some of them are facts and some of them might not be facts. There's no way to tell what is true and what is not true. There is no one version of history, but multiple versions of history. And then it's just a matter of opinion. Now, when you don't have facts, you don't have principles, and you don't have logic, when asked for an opinion, what is left? I think all is left is emotion. All is left is feelings. That's it. Now, this was 1984. This was the state of education in 1984. And there's very little reason to believe that it's improved since then. What we're seeing today at our universities, what we're seeing today with the microaggression and the triggering and all this nonsense, is the culmination of this trend. Now, what we're seeing today is the culmination of this elevation of feeling above thought. What we're seeing today is the idea that truth comes from emotion, if there is such a thing as a truth. That there is, and indeed, by coddling, and this is the point, this is a very good point that this article in The Atlantic makes, that by coddling this notion of microaggression, coddling this idea that we have to warn people that they might be offended. Can you imagine reading The Fountainhead and the sex scenes there, I'm sure, would be triggering to lots of people. Atlas Shrugged is one, a whole big trigger, because it is a celebration of the mind and individuality and production and success. And it repudiates 2,000 years of philosophy. Massive triggering all over the place. What we do when he coddle this idea, is we reinforce the supremacy of emotions. What we do when he coddle this idea is destroy the ability. We don't challenge. We don't use logic. We don't encourage the students to use logic. No, it's all about emotion. So this idea of this progressive education in our schools has now reached a point where the products of this progressive education are just emotional ejaculators. That's all they can do. All right, I think Liron here wanted to ask a question. Let's see if we can get him on the line. And let's see, there he is. Hey, Liron, you're on the line.
I can hear that. Can I be heard?
You can be heard really well this time.
Yeah, I moved. My question was, this is from a while ago when you talked about laws. Is it better to be in a, I don't know, a environment, community, country, collection, where people don't respect the law and the law is rotten, like, I don't know, the United States, or to be in a country where people, you know, go up, pass the law left and right, do business under the table, bribe officials, and the law is basically the same, if not a bit worse.
This is our topic from last week, not the topic from this week, but let me quickly answer that. Well, it depends how bad the laws are. it depends how bad the laws are. That is, if the laws are so bad that one can literally not act because the laws are handcuffing you, then it's better to be in a place where nobody regards the laws and you can get around them. But if I had to choose between living in the United States, which has bad laws, but not so bad as to completely cripple you, and living in a place where you basically have to bribe people and you have to do stuff under the table and so on, I still would much rather the United States, because essentially when you're using bribes and when you're going under the table and when you're basically saying force is okay, and you're giving the powers to be the ability at any time to shut you down. There's no rule of law. Law is gone. And therefore, when there's no rule of law, there's the rule of the gun. And what you get is the mafia-like conditions of Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union.
And I was thinking Venezuela.
Or Venezuela. So that is a disaster, Venezuela today. That is a disaster for human progress and human ability. Today in the United States, you can still fight certain laws. And yes, you can go around the laws. I mean, we have whole industries that are dedicated to going around the laws and manipulating the laws. Uber does that very well. Much of the financial industry in the United States does that well or not so well. But you still have a court. You still have appeals. You can't have a government guy, for the most part. Now, it's getting worse and worse. Just come up to you with a gun and force you to do stuff you don't want to do. Now, it's changing and it's getting worse. But we're still, you know, I still think today we're in a better state than Venezuela, than Argentina, than Russia is and was. But I want to shift back to this issue.
So,
and I promise we'll get back to the whole rule of law, cronyism.
Can I comment something?
Sure, go ahead.
I thought so too. I agree with your point, but I want to add that there is one advantage to the, you know, place where everyone bribes each other. There, nobody can pretend that the law is good. Everybody knows the law is rotten and you have to bribe things. So respect for the, even the reason for the bad law might be challenged. So you don't go, well, we need regulations to blah, blah, blah. Here people say, the hell with it.
Yeah, but there's no example in history, as far as I know, where a situation like that has led to freedom and led to good laws. What usually that leads to is a continuous deterioration, and then people are saying, oh, enough of this corruption, enough of this. And what is the result? A strong man who has very clear laws and imposes them on you and shuts you all down. So it's still easier, I think, to fight for freedom and to fight for better laws in a system where there's a respect for the law than in a system where all respect for law has gone.
Good.
All right.
Thanks for taking my call. Talk to you later.
My pleasure. Anytime. All right, so we are talking about we're talking about microaggression and triggering and look, this is becoming institutionalized. This is not freaky stuff, as I try to say. Presidents of universities, whole university systems, are doing this, and in a sense of speech, what they're attempting to do here is clearly restrict speech, limit speech, constrain speech, all in the name of not offending, all in the name of emotion, all in the name of subjectivism. There is no right, there is no wrong, there is no truth, there is no falsehood. All there is your emotions. All there is your emotions. You can't have critical thinking, because you can't challenge anybody. The whole idea of critical thinking is that people challenge and you debate and you discuss and you don't agree. Or at least as a professor, you get the students to a point of disagreement so that they can practice real skills. But to do that, to have critical thinking skills, and this is something the article misses, this relates to and what Leonard Peikoff you know, is so adamant about, is to have the basic logic skills. You have to have a certain epistemological framework. First, you have to have a metaphysical framework, which is reality exists. Perceptions are valid. But when we are arguing, logic requires conceptualization. It requires a certain process, which the human mind can do, if guided right, of turning perceptions into concepts. And the idea of truth and the idea of an objective reality and our ability to know that objective reality through our perception and our conceptualization. So an epistemology, what is required here is an epistemology, a philosophy that teaches kids not just to emote, not just to have an opinion, not just to have views, not just to be able to identify random concretes, but to actually conceptualize those concretes into ideas, into thoughts, and ultimately into principles that can then guide further thinking, more abstract thinking, so that you can actually have a discussion. You can actually have critical thinking. We can actually have a process of discovery of truth. But everything they're taught today, everything they're taught in school, or most of what they're taught in school, and most of what these professors teach them, and most of what their philosophy teachers teach them, is that none of that exists. There is no objective reality. Reason is impotent, or as a product of your race, or a product of your gender, and cannot therefore be counted on. And as a consequence of that, as we said, all you're left with is your subjective emotions that, of course, unexplained. That's the other thing about emotions, right? Emotions can be explained. Emotions can be changed. And one of the positives in this article, in the Atlantic Magazine of all places, is that they argue that emotions can be changed. That through certain psychological processes, cognitive psychology, and whether those processes are right or wrong, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not commenting on. But the idea that through the use of reason, through the use of thought, through adherence to reality, you can change your emotions. Important, crucial idea. That emotions are not truths in and of themselves, they are products of ideas we already have. They are products of conclusions we've already come to. And the way to change those emotions is to change the conclusions and to be explicit about changing those conclusions and practice changing those conclusions. And once we change those conclusions, our emotions will change. It takes time. It's not easy. This is what psychology, real psychology, would do, would help us do that, would help us achieve that. All right. So, through this, through coddling the emotions of our students today, we're basically telling them that the emotions cannot be changed, should not be changed. The emotions should be celebrated, whether they're healthy or unhealthy, whether they're justified or unjustified, whether they come from a rational source or just from a completely rational fear, and they should be guided by the group. And there's certain things they can't say, particularly if they're in the majority group, or in the what used to be the oppressor group. There's certain things they just cannot say. They cannot think. That's ruled out. So what's interesting is, this is not about free speech, as the left used to be about, right? Even the 60s, with its nihilism, supposedly the students were out there saying, free speech, anybody can say anything they want. They were subjectivists. Their subjectivism led them to conclusion that they should be able to be against the war, they should be able to challenge authority, they should be able to challenge things, right? Today, that same subjectivism forced circle back to authoritarianism, the authoritarianism of the mob, the authoritarianism of emotion, the authoritarianism of collectivism. This is the ultimate product of that 60s ideology. This is about you cannot speak. You cannot think. You cannot challenge. Accept. Become part of the group. Stop thinking. We'll be right back after this.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
We're back. We're talking about emotionalism, subjectivism, as manifest on American campuses today with a campaign against microaggression and professors having to have trigger warnings on all of their literature. And as the authors of this article, and I strongly recommend this latest edition of the Atlantic magazine, it has 3 articles on this issue, and they're all excellent. I mean, again, don't agree with everything they've written, but they have fabulous examples, and they analyze this really well. I mean, you got to give them credit. They're very thoughtful and interesting. One of the things they say is that today, in academic circles, you cannot blame the victim in quotes here, because it's unacceptable to ever question the reasonableness of someone's emotional state, particularly if those emotions are linked to one's group identity. I'm quoting from the authors. I'm offended, they say, becomes an unbeatable trump card. That is, I'm offended beats any argument. You can't argue with it. Now, emotions are not good or bad in and of itself. It's the evaluations that cause the emotions that are going to be judged. But you can say to somebody, you know, being offended by what I just said is not reasonable. The evaluation that led to that emotion, the emotion is what it is. But the evaluation that led to that emotion, that's not reasonable. You should examine that. You can't do that today. You cannot challenge people. Emotions are truths. They are the end. There's no challenging anything because challenge them based on what? Reason is out. Reality is out. Facts are out. All you've got is a bunch of people emoting. And their emotions are all right. Now, note that if you're white and you have a particular emotion, I don't know, if you're a white male, your emotions aren't taken as end products. Your emotions are disregarded completely. Nobody cares about your emotions. Right? It's, as this article says, it's the group identity, the ones linked to group identity. And group here, they mean group is a keyword to minority or some group that's being oppressed or some reason, right? Yeah. So, now, one of the really alarming trends here is that this has been, in a sense, institutionalized into our legal framework now. So, historically, the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights has said, you know, to be really offended, to get federal anti-discrimination status, the action has to be objectively offensive before it could be, for example, sexual harassment or racist or something like that, right? So in order to actually bring a legal case against somebody or to go after a university for encouraging this kind of behavior, you actually had to make an objective case that this was offensive. And there were all kinds of standards, and I'm sure the standards were bad, and I'm sure even that, you know, all of those rules should be scrapped. All of those rules are non-objective. All of those rules are bad. But it's gotten a lot worse. Because in 2013, the Department of Justice and Education changed. They broadened the definition of sexual harassment and thus broadened the definition of harassment more generally, not just around sex. And how did they broaden the definition of harassment? It now included any verbal conduct that is unwelcomed. So the standard was not now, is this objectively harassing? Is this objectively offensive? You know, if we look at it, if we examine the facts, did what this person say really, was it mean, right? Not that that should should be cause for legal action, but at least there was a semblance of some objectivity here, right? Now, the only standard is the other person's emotional response. What does it mean to be unwelcomed? What does it mean to be unwelcomed? By the way, I'm constantly being harassed by leftists, socialists, collectivists, altruists. I find almost everything that they say unwelcome. I find almost anything that they say emotionally upsetting and emotionally harassing. And yet, what do you think? I have a chance of winning that lawsuit, huh? No. Because I'm fighting for individualism. No, because I'm not part of an oppressed group. Although, maybe I could play the Jewish card. I wonder if I could do that. Play the anti-Semitic card. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, if you define unwelcome speech as harassment, I mean, and now we're talking about sex, race, religion, even veteran status. Veteran status is now considered, you know, you could be harassed if it's unwelcome. It's, you know, some comment about you being a veteran. So now, what the authors of this article call emotional reasoning, there's a contradiction in terms, but emotional reasoning is now accepted. And they define emotional reasoning because this is part of the vocabulary today on campuses. Emotional reasoning, according to these two books in psychology or whatever, are called assume that your negative emotions necessarily reflect the way things really are. So emotion as truth of reality, not truth about your state. Emotions are what they are, but truth about reality. I felt it, therefore it must be true. I'm offended, therefore you must have offended me. A different book defines emotional reasoning as your feelings as guide to your interpretation of reality. Now that's as explicit as it can get. So what our universities are teaching us, what our universities are reinforcing, because our schools have already taught us, is that our emotions are guides to truth, guides to reality. They can have never be questioned. Indeed, our universities are teaching us something more than that. They're teaching their students that emotions can be used as effective weapons. They can silence other people. They can get other people in trouble. Just saying I'm offended can get a professor fired, can get other students, you know, fired from student newspapers. That's happened. Sanctions against, academic sanctions against certain students. Our schools are training students to emote, to view emotions as the standard of knowledge. Now, what's going to happen to these kids when they get out of school? What's going to happen to these kids when they actually have to face reality, when they have to work for a living, when they have to produce, when they have to use their mind in order to survive? Well, many of them will end up on welfare. Maybe this is why so many of them are still living with their parents. Right? Many of them will go to touchy-feely companies that never really produce much, that respect their emotions. But most of them are going to get slapped in the face because, and this is the great savior of America. The great savior of America is that most business doesn't put up with this BS. The savior of this country is that when these kids go into the workforce, they get slapped side of the head with a dose of reality that forces this garbage, not completely out of their system, but at least a little bit. But this is the emotionalism that feeds our political system. This is the emotionalism that feeds our constant systematic march towards authoritarianism, towards statism, and away from freedom. This is what our schools are doing. This is the consequence of an evil philosophy that rejects reason, rejects reality, and as a consequence rejects the individual and leaves us just as feeling, emoting, subjectivist members of a mob that need, at the end of the day, need in order to survive to be ruled by some authoritarian who actually knows something, because we certainly don't know anything. All we can do is emote. Now, what's interesting is in the article, it's got a lot of good stuff. But in terms of how we got here, what I find fascinating is they don't really blame progressive education. And, of course, progressive education, the whole idea of education, the purpose of education is to coddle, the purpose of education is to socialize, the purpose of education is not to teach facts or principles or logic, but to teach random instances, random percepts, not to integrate, not to use our conceptual faculty, but to reject the conceptual faculty. That is why we have the state we have today. It's the 60s generation who then became teachers and professors who generated, and parents who generated what we have today. Indeed, it's interesting, but the authors blame this on the coddling of American children by their parents, of the spoiling of American children by their parents since the 1960s, particularly when the 60s generation became parents in the 80s and 90s, or the children, I guess, of the children, the millennials, were spoiled. So the authors here argue that when we were growing up, me, them, I'll tell you how I was growing up. When I grew up, I came home from school. I put my backpack down and said, hi, Mom. Bye, Mom. See you for dinner. And I left. And there were no cell phones. And there was no way for my mom to get a hold of me. And I came back for dinner. And she didn't know where I was. And I went all over the place. I took my bike, rode all over town. And this is Israel, not the safest place in the world, but not a particularly violent place in terms of internally. I had a childhood that was basically not ruled by adults. We used to throw rocks at one another. We used to have rock wars, my neighborhood against the neighborhood next door. We used to play soccer in the street on asphalt, and we used to have to run to get the ball every time a car would pass. Kids almost got run over regularly. We climbed trees. We scraped our knees. We cut ourselves. We stepped on nails. We lived as kids, independent lives. We learned to deal with reality, is the point the author is making, and I agree with this point. We always had a better schooling system than what they do today, and he doesn't recognize that, and I do. Today, and I can tell you even for my kids, I mean, I'm as guilty as this as many of these parents, although I try to fight against this. We pick up our kids at school. God forbid they should walk anyway. We take them shopping. We take them to class. We take them here. We take them there. Kids don't climb trees anymore. Certainly kids don't go out into the street by themselves, maybe to play basketball right here in front of the house. But they wouldn't go to another street or another neighborhood. Certainly not at age 8 or 9, which I was when I first started walking around the neighborhood and going places and crossing streets. Kids are coddled. They don't deal with physical reality. They don't deal with reality. Now, again, I don't think this is the major cause. The major cause of the problems we face is progressive education. But this is one of the causes of that. It's that we fear reality because we don't know reality. We fear the world because all we have is our emotions to deal with the world. And as parents, all we're focused on is fear. And we spoil our kids because we're afraid to do anything else. We're afraid, guided by emotion. So what is the cure? What is the cure? And here, it's amazed me when I got to this part of the article, because the title of this part of the article is The Thinking Cure. The cure is to teach kids to think. The cure is reason. The cure, unfortunately, needs to happen in primary schools, in kindergartens, in high schools. We need to teach kids to think. We need to teach them thinking skills. We need to challenge them. We need to engage them with reality. We need to teach them principles, and we need to engage their conceptual faculty, encourage them to be conceptual, but teach them how to do that. It's a skill. It's a science, if you will. Science is called epistemology. So Dr. Peikoff, towards the end of his lecture, this is his lecture on why Johnny can't think, which is as relevant today as it was back then, probably much, much more relevant. This is 30 years later, right? 32 years later. So this is quoting Dr. Peikoff. We need a philosophy that will teach our colleges, and thereby our school teachers, and thus finally our youngsters, an abiding respect for reason, for man's mind, for the conceptual level of consciousness. Now that, if I may say so, is why I subscribe to the philosophy of Ayn Rand. This is Leonard, but I agree. To my knowledge, hers is the only such philosophy in America today. It could be the wonder cure that will revive a generation, indeed multiple generations. So the cure to microaggression, the triggering cure to the problems we have in the world, is philosophy. And in this case, it's a respect for reason and a respect for reality, a respect for the human mind. And, you know, what's going on today in campuses is truly, truly scary. It needs to be fought. It needs to be fought everywhere. And you who are listening, you're probably not familiar with this, because this does not get reported. It's not out there as the prevalent, because this is, you know, what happens at universities. But if your kids, if you're a parent, be aware. This needs to be fought. If you're a teacher, be aware of what you're doing. You're destroying these kids. Destroying these kids. You're destroying all of our future. We'll be right back with a twist to the positive, some positive values.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism, and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Meet your fellow Ayn Rand admirers from around the country for an evening celebrating the ideas of Atlas Shrugged. Join them on the evening of September 29th at the St. Regis Hotel in Manhattan for the 7th Annual Atlas Shrugged Revolution Benefit Dinner and Live Auction. More than 5 decades after its publication, Atlas Shrugged continues to influence millions of people, and each year thousands more are introduced to and forever changed by Ayn Rand's magnum opus. Find out why and how the Ayn Rand Institute is promoting Rand's ideas throughout the United States and around the world. You'll be supporting the work of the Ayn Rand Institute to encourage even more young people to read and study Ayn Rand's novels in the years ahead. Visit online at aynrand.org/NYC or call us toll-free at 800-365-6552, extension 204. Seating is limited, so make sure to call or go online. That's aynrand.org/NYC or call 800-365-6552, extension 204.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
All right, so this is where I present you with some positive values, things that I like, not objectivist art. This is not objectively good. This is movies Yaron likes, and movies, music. We'll talk about other art forms as well over the weeks, over the months, over the years to come. But I want to, given the negativity of the previous topic, I wanted to, talk about a couple of I think enjoyable movies. One very new and one very old, both romantic comedies or romantic movies with comedic elements. that I really enjoy, that I really liked. The first one is a modern movie that I saw just recently. Never heard of it. My wife had recommended it to her, and we watched it the other night. And it's called 527. Number five, the word 27. So between 5 to 7, think of it that way. It's a romance, and I found it charming. Now I have to say, torn about the ending. I'm not going to give it away, but I'm torn about the ending. But I really enjoyed this, and maybe part of this is that I found the actress just to be unbelievably gorgeous. So I have to admit my subjective biases. Her name's Berenice Malot. I'd never seen her before, but she was just charming and gorgeous. By the way, the New York Times hated this movie, so I'm glad I liked it. It's also with Anton Yelchin, who I've never heard of. So I'd never heard of the actors. Director is Victor Levin. I've never heard of him. I think you can get it on pretty much anywhere, Netflix and so on. We downloaded it from DirecTV. Love at First Sight with Complications. But a movie that deeply believes in love at first sight. Just that is quite stunning and amazing. And I found both characters to be just really amazing. And she exuded sex appeal and is just charming and beautiful. So yes, somebody on the chat said she played in Skyfall, James Bond's Skyfall. And I have to admit, I don't remember her from there, but she was sexier in this movie than she was in James Bond's movie, because I would have remembered her if she was this sexy in James Bond. So encourage you to watch it. She was sexy. It's an R-rated movie. I think it should be PG, because there was no nudity in it. I don't know why it's all, maybe language. I have no idea. Anyway, charming. Really enjoyed it. All right. The other movie is all out, one of my favorites. No caveats in this one. This is a masterpiece. I mean, in my view, I love this movie. It's called Shop Around the Corner. The Shop Around the Corner. It's with Margaret Sullivan and James Stewart. This is an old movie, 1940. It's by the person I think is the greatest director of comedy of all time, Ernst Lubitsch. I think in a previous episode of the Ron Brooks Show, I talked about Ernst Lubitsch. I recommended everything he did, and I do. This is just a wonderful, wonderful romantic comedy. It's been remade in a variety of different ways over and over and over and over again over the years. You Got Mail. You remember You Got Mail? Is basically a remake of Shop Around the Corner, but you got to see the original. The original is beautifully made, charming characters, unbelievable benevolence, real romanticism, happy ending, just a fun, great, values driven movie, and really everything Lubitsch did was beautifully made, and everything Lubitsch did is funny. Everything he did was original and smart. Now, Shop Around the Corner might not have come across as original because it's been remade so many times. But when it first came out, it was that as well. So, two movies, 527 and Shop Around the Corner. And I have a request, two requests. One is, I'd like to know what you think about the movies I recommend. I kind of put it out into the ether and you guys listen. And if you like the movies, or if you don't like the movies, you hate them. Either way, let me know. Right? Let me know. So you can tweet. You can let me know on Twitter, Yaron Brook or just Yaron Brook on Twitter, or Facebook. You can send me a thing on Facebook. Yaron Brook on Facebook. You can like me, and you can also friend me on Facebook. You can do either one of those because I have two pages. I guess I prefer that you like me, but you can do either one of those. And there's also an email address for this radio show. and I'll give that to you next time. But so please let me know what you think about the movies. And the second thing, feel free to let me know, is what topics I should cover on the show, and if you have specific questions you would like answered. So specific questions about pretty much anything that you would like answered, send me a message with the question, and we'll try to cover those. All right. Have a good weekend. It's a long weekend. Enjoy. You've been listening to the Iran Book Show.